Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you sign up for the event in Las Vegas. That is October 15 and 16. It's in Las Vegas, exactly the place that Jesus would be if he were walking the earth right now. He'd make a beeline for Vegas. And, you know, as 1517 tries to emulate Christ, we will be there as well, mixing it up with all the sinners.
That was a good, you know, Dan, I got to give you props. I mean, you made a valiant effort.
I did. So you got to come to Vegas. Imitate us as we imitate Jesus. $65. You want to come out, hang out with us, and it's going to be a good time. Eric, we are in Mark chapter 4. Well, we just got done with Jesus telling some parables, telling some stories. Yep. And now he's done with his storytelling. Time to get in a boat to get away from all these people.
Yeah, well, we're going from Jesus telling parables, which we've written a book about, to Jesus performing miracles, which we have a book coming out about at some point in the future, which we'll give you more details about that at some time in the future,
yeah,
dear listeners. But so we pick it up at Mark chapter 4, verse 35. It says, "On that day when evening had come, he said to them, 'Let us go across to the other side.' And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, 'Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?' And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, 'Peace, be still.' And the wind ceased, and there was great calm." Now, Dan, before we move on to what Jesus has to say to them after this event, I am struck by the question that the disciples have, because I think this question can be applied to, well, basically all of humanity at any given time or another. I mean, any human being has probably found themselves asking the question of God, "Do you not care?
Yeah.
Are you noticing the storm I'm in? Are you noticing the trouble I'm going through?" And in this case, they're convinced that they're going
to
die.
What you have in this text, I like that question, and I'm going to respond to what you were just saying. But first, just in the narrative of the story, do you get the impression that Jesus is exhausted? I get the impression that he's exhausted, that he's got all these crowds coming out to him. He's teaching him and stuff, and he makes this statement, "Look, let's go across to the other side." And this has then left the crowd, right?
Yeah,
and
let me get a break.
Like, Jesus is tired. This is the humanity of Jesus is on display here, where Jesus is exhausted. He has been teaching and preaching and doing miracles, and the crowds are getting bigger and bigger because the lepers won't shut up, and all of this is happening. And he gets in the boat, and what does he do as soon as he says, "We're going to their side"? He is out.
Yeah, our Lord is not averse to naps.
No, he's
a nap guy.
He's asleep. He finds a cushion, gets on that cushion, and he is out. And he is so out that this storm is raging, and he's asleep.
Yep.
He's asleep. He's exhausted. And the boat starts filling up with water. They have to wake him up. And they say these words that you referenced, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Now, this is how I think a lot of people feel when things are going on, when life is difficult.
Yep.
They do think, like, is God straight up taking a nap right now? Is God paying attention to this at all? Is God aware of it? Is he sleeping through this? Or maybe he just doesn't care.
Yeah.
The answer to the question, of course, we'll get there. But the answer to it is, yes, he does care. It's interesting that you have this word that he rebuked the wind and the sea.
Yeah.
And said, "Peace, be still." Mm-hmm. It doesn't say that he turned around and rebuked the disciples for this sort of prayer, this sort of request, this sort of statement. Now, he is going to say something to them.
Yeah, he's going to challenge them.
But it's the storm that gets rebuked, right? So the storm gets rebuked. Then he turns to them and says, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?"
Yeah.
And so what you have in there is that's his answer to teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? What he wants them to believe, of course, is that I've got you.
Yes. Right? That's exactly right.
That's what it is. So, like, yeah, this is scary. Yeah, this is, you're in danger here. But what you got to believe is I got you. And so what faith is in this context is believing that Jesus does care for you despite everything else going on.
Yeah. Despite the storms, despite the boat filling up with water and feeling overwhelmed with the circumstance, which all of the disciples clearly are, it is the ability to say in that moment, Jesus does care, and I'm crying out to him as one who does care for me, who hears my prayer, who hears my need. And indeed, Jesus is, I mean, with a word, is able to end the storm immediately.
Yeah.
Peace, be still.
Yeah, and in the greater context of what Jesus is going to do in his ministry, this statement, I mean, you think about this hitting the ears of Jesus. Jesus, who knows what he is here to do, as we've talked about, he is taking sin upon himself. He knows he is here to die for the sins of the world.
Yeah.
And you have your disciples say to you, do you not care that we are perishing?
Yeah, he could have gotten up and said, why do you think I'm here?
Yeah.
Like, have you not heard me?
Yeah, I mean,
like, this is exactly why I'm here, because yeah. I do care that you're all perishing.
Yeah, I can't hear this language of, do you not care that we're perishing, without hearing John 3:16, right? That
yeah.
For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believes in him shall not perish. That this is the reason I'm here is that you may not perish. And not just from some storm. I'm trying to make sure that I'm going to ensure that you don't perish, period. That you don't perish eternally.
Yeah.
In fact, yeah, only thing I care about is you not perishing.
And what's interesting is right after this, we're still told that they're filled with great fear and said to one another, who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? And so there's a sense here in which the one kind of fear they had, which is of dying in this storm, is replaced by a greater fear, a better fear, the kind of fear that Luther talks about in the Small Catechism, that you know, when you'll see often, if you ever come across the Small Catechism listener, that Luther will answer a question by saying, this means that we should fear and love God, and then go on to give an explanation. Well, what is meant by this fear is reverence, respect, awe. There's a sense in which, after seeing him just get up and literally rebuke the storm into silence, that they are filled with a greater sense of awe for him than they were for the storm that they thought was killing him. And so the question is this sort of, they're baffled, like, who, like, okay, we've heard him say some things and we've seen him do some things that made us believe he was something special, but man, who really is he that he can do this?
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it's a wild thing, because they wake him up and they're basically saying, are you going to do anything about this? And then he does something about it and they can't believe it.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, oh, you really are who you say you are.
Like, I don't know if they woke him up and, like, were, you know, saying, hey man, grab an oar or something, you know, like, you know, yeah. Get a bucket and start, like, we're trying to get the water out here. I don't know what they were thinking he was going to do, but apparently it wasn't this.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's funny that they're shocked by this, even though they ask him to do it, clearly believing that he might have some power to do something about it.
Yeah.
Indeed, he does.
Yeah. And the reason, of course, for us, this is such a beautiful passage, is because when we are tempted to ask this question or believe that God doesn't care about what happens to us, and we all have been there and we'll all be there again, mm-hmm. that the answer to the question, does God not care if we perish? We get the answer ultimately to that at the cross, where God says, this is how much I care about you not perishing. I care about you living forever this much.
That I'm willing to perish myself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the answer to the question, do you not care that we're perishing, is the cross.
Yeah, that's right. And so we enter into chapter 5, verse 1. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. Now, Dan, a few just notes to make about what we've read so far about this situation. One is to point out that the location that they're at, the country of the Gerasenes, was known for being a highly Gentile area. And therefore, it sort of had this reputation of being unclean. It was a place of uncleanness. Therefore, it may not have been too terribly surprising for the early readers of this narrative to read that this is a place where you come across a man who is severely oppressed, indeed possessed, by demons. And in such a way that he's actually doing all sorts of self-harm, cutting himself, crying out all day and night. It does, Dan, you got to wonder how much this must have affected even psychologically the rest of the people around this guy having to live with him constantly crying out and cutting himself and doing all these things. I mean, it must have been a pretty horrific scene.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, obviously Jesus is, when he gets in this boat to go over there, he's escaping the crowds, but he's leaving the crowds to go to a single man.
Yeah, that's right.
Jesus knows what he's doing. And yeah. So he's leaving the crowd behind to address this man's specific need, and a man that no one else wants to deal with, a man that no one else can deal with.
No one else can deal with it, and no one else wants to deal with it. If anything, this is a man that would have been seen as nothing but a public nuisance to everyone.
Yes, yes. I mean, and kind of terrifying, right? I mean, it sounds terrifying.
Yeah, yeah, it does sound like something out of a horror movie. Nevertheless, and when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him, and crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." So that gives you the indication that this man is not just possessed by one demon, but is possessed by many demons, and therefore all the more tormented by this demonic presence. Verse 10, and he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. Well, Dan, what is going on here? I mean, we've got a pretty vivid story of what happens to these demons as Jesus expels them from the man, and they go into a herd of pigs. The pigs head down into the sea. What say you?
Well, first you have the demons knowing that they're about to get cast out. They cannot, they have already lost this fight. They know that if Jesus says get out, then you are to get out. Now, pigs, of course, are unclean animals for Jews, and so they say, "Hey, you know, you could send us into those pigs because we're unclean, they're unclean, you know, no harm, no foul, you know, what they're not wanting to do is be destroyed." And so they're saying, we'll leave. We have no choice. But don't destroy us. Just send us over there. Mm-hmm. Well, Jesus has every intention of destroying them. And so what he does is he sends them into the pigs and says, "That's fine. The unclean goes with the unclean." And then a whole herd of pigs goes down into the water and drown. And what you have here is a picture of how Jesus deals with what is unclean. Jesus means to drown that which is unclean. So all these pigs get baptized, and all these unclean spirits get drowned in the water. And this is exactly what happens with us. I mean, we might not be walking around demon possessed, but all the works of the devil and all the things that would seek to own us and claim us and all our sin is likewise drowned in water.
Yeah. And what's left is a new creation. Mm-hmm. A man who is no longer afflicted by the pain and the horror of the past.
Yes.
But is now a new creation, completely free.
Yes. Yes.
So it really is just a beautiful picture of baptism. And yet, just as not everyone will respond with joy at the sight of a newly baptized new creation today, so too, not everyone responds with joy at the new creation before us in our story. Verse 14, the herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country, and people came to see what it was that happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. So they, I mean, this is clearly, some, this man had a reputation. These people are seeing this. This is a new man, new creation. And you would expect, even just out of a little sympathy for this man, Dan, that they go, hooray, hallelujah, yay, good news. But that's not what we're going to read.
No, I mean, they believe that there's something miraculous, that they believe that something miraculous has just happened. They believe that someone powerful is in their midst. And what they know for sure is that somebody just lost 2,000 pigs.
What it comes down to is, in fact, that. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs, and they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. Yes, instead of celebrating Jesus being with them, the one who has the power to expel the demonic, the one who has the power to calm the storms, they see Jesus's presence with them as a threat to everything they had known, which is their livelihood based on the pigs. And so they beg him to leave. Get away from us. We don't want whatever you've got.
Yeah, I mean, they're like, this healing is nice. This miracle is nice. Good for him. But you're upsetting the economic system here that we got to go. You know, we have a certain industry here with the pigs. And I don't want you running across any more demon-possessed guys and casting them into any more herds of pigs.
Well, and you do see this trend continue in the early church, too. I can't help but think about the book of Acts, in which, the city of Ephesus has such a sort of wild conversion rate to the Christian faith that a bunch of people start throwing out their idols to Diana, and there's no longer any temple worship. And so all the idol makers who had made their living making these idols of Diana suddenly don't have anybody buying their product. And what do? They protest against the Christians, hoping to get them out because the Christians are having such an impact on creating new life that no longer is enslaved to these idols. And so this is not unheard of, this sort of response from people. Whenever Jesus comes in and starts upsetting the way that people are used to living, you can expect that there's going to be pushback from certain people. It's inevitable. And so we read in verse 18, as he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. So that's the one man that wants him to stay. Don't go. Wherever you're going, I want to be with you. And he did not permit him, but said to him, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. So here's interesting, Dan. This time Jesus says, all right, go ahead.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things that are interesting. One is that you think that, like, when Jesus does something incredible for you, you know, like save you, that you have to go and do something. You have to go and do something incredible for God. You have to go follow Jesus. But sometimes following Jesus just means staying put and extolling the grace, the goodness, and the mercy of Jesus. Sometimes it's that. In fact, most of the times it's that.
That's right. And then, so the man indeed does that very thing. He goes and talks about Jesus to his friends, tells them everything that Jesus had done for them. Verse 20, and he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. Now, I always have to point this out whenever I go through this story, Dan, because I find it a fascinating thing. I mean, the Christian faith and its spread begins with this one man who had been so oppressed by demons. All we know is this one man starts going out and telling his friends about Jesus to the Decapolis, and that's all the story tells us. But what we know from history, what we know from archaeology, is it turns out that one of the heaviest populated areas of churches in the ancient world that we have ruins of is, in fact, in the Decapolis. But it started with this one formerly demon-possessed man, a man who everyone thought maybe was left for dead, who had no chance of being effective at anything in the rest of his life. This man went out, started proclaiming the gospel, and years later, it became a hotbed of Christian faith all over the land.
Yeah, yeah, it's a, and this is exactly why Jesus tells him to stay put.
That's amen. That's right.
And much like you always bring that up, I think, and I'm positive that I brought this up when we were addressing this in previous Gospels, but I always bring this up too. One of the best songs, maybe the only song ever written about this, by Bob Bennett. Old song. I always have to read this because Bob Bennett gets to the heart of the matter, that this story is, yes, about a man, but this story is about all of us. This is what Jesus has done for all of us.
Yeah.
And so the lyrics to this song go like this. You just have to bear with me. Man of the tombs, he lives in a place where no one goes. He tears at himself and lives with a pain that no one knows. He counts himself dead among the living. He knows no mercy and no forgiving. Deep in the night, he's driven to cry out loud. Man of the tombs, possessed by an unseen enemy, he breaks every chain and mistakes his freedom for being free. Shame and shamelessness equally there, like a random toss of a coin in the air. Man of the tombs, he's driven to cry out loud. Underneath this thing that I've become, a fading memory of flesh and blood, I curse the womb, I bless the grave, I've lost my heart and cannot be saved. Like those who fear me, I am afraid. Like those I've hurt, I feel pain. Naked now before my sin and these stones that cut against my skin. Some try to touch me, but no one can, for man of the tombs I am. Down at the shoreline, two sets of footprints meet. One is screaming, the other one speaks. In only a moment and only a word, the evil departs like a thundering herd. Man of the tomb, he hears this cry out loud. Underneath this thing that you've become, I see a man of flesh and blood. I give you life beyond the grave. I heal your heart. I come to save. No need to fear. Be not afraid. This man of sorrows knows your pain. I come to take away your sin and bear its marks upon my skin. When no one can touch you, still I can, for Son of God I am. Dressed now and seated, clean in spirit and healthy of mind. Man of the tombs, he begs to follow but must stay behind. He'll return to his family with stories to tell of mercy and madness and heaven and hell. Man of the tombs, soon he will cry out loud. Underneath this thing I once was, now I'm a man of flesh and blood. I have life beyond the grave. I've found my heart and I can now be saved. No need to fear, I am not afraid. This man of sorrows took my pain. He comes to take away our sin and bear its marks upon his skin. I'm telling you this story because man of the tombs I was.
Fantastic, Dan. Yeah, that's awesome. And it's just such an encouraging story to see the great reversal that takes place when Jesus comes across a sinful man, when Jesus comes across an oppressed man, when Jesus comes across anyone who is fallen and lost. Jesus is able to reconcile them all. And so we move on to verse 21, where Jesus indeed will interact with more people that are indeed victims of being in a lost world. Verse 21, and when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him, and there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and who had suffered much under many physicians, and had spent all that she had, and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, "If I touch even his garments, I will be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." Now, let's just stop there for a second, because it's a powerful story of a woman who's basically lost all hope, who has tried everything at her disposal. She's spent everything she has. She's been dealing with this for 12 years. I mean, so this is a long-standing disease and has filled her life with much difficulty. She's gone to every doctor. She's gone to NYU Medical. She's done everything she's supposed to do, and no one can help. And so out of desperation, she finally just comes to Jesus to see if there's something he can do. And yet she does it in a way like she doesn't want to bother him. Like she doesn't want, she just wants to, she's, I just, if I just touch his garments, maybe that will be the trick.
Well, the story is wild because you have this guy whose daughter is ill.
Yeah.
And you, and Jesus is on his way to heal her.
Yeah. And the first thing that sticks out to me about the story is Jairus may have been sitting there being like, all right, yeah, I mean, just let it go. Let's go. Let's go to the house.
I mean, if you're with Jairus and you're like, okay, my daughter's ill. She needs to be healed. And there's, then you have this woman of the issue of blood, which, by the way, would make her unclean. So one of the reasons she's not going to go approach Jesus and say anything to Jesus is that she's not supposed to be around people right now. She is unclean. So she has been for 12 years, presumably, not able to really participate in society, certainly not able to participate in the worship life of Israel, none of this stuff. Mm-hmm. But Jesus is wandering through the crowd. He's trying to get to this guy's daughter. And he stops and says this, "Who touched me?" I mean, you see the disciples, they're like, okay, listen, dude, there's like a thousand people here, and like we're trying to work our way through the crowd. Did you just ask who touched you? What are you talking about? And if you're Jairus, you got to be like, dude, we don't have time to figure out who touched you. What's going on? Like, for Jesus to stop, I mean, Jairus has to be just beside himself.
Yeah.
Jesus knows the difference between someone who's grabbing at him and somebody who is grabbing at him in faith with a need.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the difference between this woman touching him and all of these other people who are touching him? Because the disciples seem to think that all kinds of people are touching you right now.
Yeah.
Jesus knows when somebody grabs a hold of him in faith. Now, we're not talking about some crazy strong faith. We're talking about a woman who had heard. She heard a rumor. She heard a story. This is a just maybe. Mm-hmm. If I can grab a hold of maybe, and that's enough. Don't get this twisted in your mind that there's some incredible great faith here. I mean, Jesus says your faith has made you well. But what kind of faith is he talking about? The kind of faith that entered her ears through people telling stories and her going and saying, you know what? I'm going to give it a shot. I'm gonna reach out and just and see. Mm-hmm. And Jesus knows the difference between that and people just brushing up against him.
Yeah. On account of that faith in Jesus, she is immediately restored to fellowship. Mm-hmm. She's immediately restored. She's healed. She's made well. She is peace is declared upon her. And she is, again, another example of a new creation after coming in contact with Jesus. But lest we fear that Jesus is just going to ignore Jairus' request for his daughter, no, he will do that. Verse 35, while he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe. I know I took some extra time, but trust me, I know what I'm doing." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat.
Yeah, so what you see here is that Jesus stops. He's having this conversation with this woman. And sure enough, Jairus gets the message that his daughter has died. Jesus has not made it there in time. But Jesus is going to say, no, actually, I'm not going to just make your daughter well. I'm going to make your daughter alive.
Yeah.
And people are in disbelief that I mean, it seems that people were willing to believe that Jesus could perhaps keep someone from dying.
Yeah.
But to raise someone back to life from the dead seemed too much.
Yeah. And just one more note before we wrap up today's episode. I love, again, the emphasis on Jesus purposely walking into the room, you know, not even acting, like actually asking the question, like, why are you worried? Why such commotion and weeping? Child's not dead, but sleeping. And then with a touch and a word, the girl is risen.
Yeah, I you have to love this as this news comes to Jairus that Jesus turns to him and says, "Do not fear, only believe." Like, he knows this is a terrifying thing. This is the worst news you could possibly get. And Jesus says, "Don't be afraid. Just believe."
Again, it goes back to the very beginning of our passages today where we looked at the calming of the storm. Jesus is saying again to Jairus, as he said to his disciples, "I got your back."
Yeah, I care.
I got you.
I'm not going to let you perish. I mean, what Jesus is saying is, when he says, "Don't be afraid, only believe," what he's saying is, you don't need to be afraid of anything. Death is sleep to me. And when Jesus does this sort of thing where he'll say, "She's just sleeping," or "He has gone," Jesus hates death. And to him, he says, death is merely sleeping, because I am going to raise people, and he's going to raise this girl back to life, but he's going to raise all of us back to eternal life. Jesus does not view death as a permanent thing for those who believe, that it is just temporary. It's just a sleep. Yeah. And so don't be afraid of it. I am the resurrection and the life.
Yeah, that's right. Amen.
And that's it, man. We went a little bit long today, but we had to get through. There's no good place to stop right there. So you get a little bit of bonus minutes. Eric, I will see you next week.
All right. Sounds good.